Welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email ogc@accessradio.biz, and biz is spelled B-I-Z, that's ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who so far in her journey has been a qualified nurse, foster carer, teacher, event manager, and a partnership coordinator on the international stage. Our guest has worked all around the world with different charities, looking after and helping children at risk. Her book, Broken Pieces, is to help those who need hope, and that beauty can come from brokenness. Creativity is key, and the book shares of her experiences dealing with, amongst other issues, cancer and miscarriage. So, why does she love making mosaics? What happens at her mosaic events? What does she mean by raw? What is the raw? What has she learned so far about being a Christian and working in the professional business world? And what has she learned so far about being a Christian when feeling broken herself? All these questions, so little time to answer them. Better meet our guest, and that today is Chrissy Wilkinson. Chrissy, thank you so much for joining us today and for your patience as well. Thank you so much. Where are we speaking to you from today?
In Oxford, actually.
Oxford, famous for the fact that the council don't like cars. Is that true?
That is very true. Yes, it's my pet peeve, actually.
Oh, is it? Oh.
Yes. It might even be something I'd like the government to change a law on.
Let's find out then, because that's one of the questions if you're Prime Minister. So I'll find out in a minute then. Thank you. Let's go for it, Chrissy, if that's okay. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask some questions, who would it be?
In actual fact, it's somebody that I did know. I do know of her. But as with people who are you'd want to spend time with, they're often very busy.
Yeah.
So I was actually thinking of this person called Susie Howe. And she was the founder of a charity called Bethany Children's Trust. It was really, she's kind of just inspired me for so long. And she has so many stories and experiences. And I ended up being a trustee of Bethany Children's Trust, which is where I got to know her a little bit better. But we're always on that kind of, you know, business edge of relationship. So when I was thinking about actually inviting somebody for a meal, I thought I would just love to have, first of all, have the time to sit down to ask questions too, because she's got such experience. Her journey with the Lord is one that I really aspire to, her relationship with God in the mix of what she does. And so, yeah, she was the person I thought of, to be honest.
That's a great answer.
Aside from the fat, I was just thinking about eating. I think when you're eating, you want to have somebody you feel comfortable with. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because food and tension don't really go together. Although often they do, ironically, don't they? But I thought, you know, she's somebody that I really know I'd feel at home with as well. So that we could actually enjoy having a meal, not, and it would be a question and answer kind of real connection.
That's a good answer. But if it was somebody from history that we might know, who would you choose as well? So you could have like a nice three or foursome there.
I mean, this is really bizarre, but somebody from history who I had thought would be interesting to meet is somebody like Teresa de Avila. You know, one of the mystics. There's a whole group of women. They were kind of considered mystics, mm-hmm. but they have books that I've had a number of the books written of their kind of journey, with relationship with God. And I do think that would be an interesting mix with Susie, because she's somebody that does the kind of spiritual with the practical. And these kind of women of history like Teresa Avila, and there's others. I mean, Julian of Norwich.
Yes.
I mean, all these kind of, I'm just thinking of the women that have stood out to me as I would really want to spend time with them, to get to know them and ask questions, particularly about how they connect their spirituality with real life, I guess.
Brilliant. And Julian Norwich was a woman.
Yes.
12th century, wasn't she, something like that?
Yeah, Norwich. I don't know the century.
It's a long time ago. So my time machine would have to go back some time. How far back in history do you have to go to get Teresa to bring her forward for the meal?
Oh, a long time ago. I mean, you're talking a few hundred. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely a few hundred.
Well, apologies for not knowing about Teresa either.
I probably said her name wrong as well. So you might get people say, she's talking about Teresa.
Her name was Diana.
Yes.
Good answers. Thank you. Question two, who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Chrissy?
I was thinking about this and I realised it was either King David or Queen Esther, and I was wondering why that was the case. And I think because both of them are stories of kind of, well, he went from shepherd to king,
uh-huh.
And she went from orphan to queen. Mm-hmm. So I really love their story and who they, how, you know, God used them and what we can learn from their lives, really.
No, that's a very good answer.
I'm only allowed one, though.
Well, it's like a favourite biblical story, so you can sort of meld them together.
Merge them. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, so we'll get round that one.
It's good.
Question three, then. Here we go.
Right.
If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
You'd be amazed how long it took me to think about this question, because it's such a deep one, isn't it? And you can end up in all sorts of rabbit holes thinking, what implication is this going to have on the world if I, you know, if you change this or that?
It can be frivolous. It doesn't have to be.
Okay, I'll do. I mean, the frivolous one was, I was thinking, was actually, I don't know if it's frivolous, but it would be a real fun thing,
yeah.
Is to, for a day, people swap wages. So the rich will swap wages with the poor. You know, there's a TV program on at the moment where they're swapping, I don't actually watch it, but I've seen it advertised, where they swap people's families. So rich people will go on holiday, like a poor person would go on holiday, and the poor person would take their holiday.
Yeah.
But I actually think it'd be really fun to have a day where everybody has an opportunity to swap a day's wage with somebody on the opposite spectrum to them, just to, I don't know. It would be such a big social experiment, wouldn't it?
Yes. I'm just thinking, I can't see it happening, though. I can see as soon as you start the first sentence, there's going to be point of order, out of order. You can't do that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a shame.
It's a great idea, but all of a sudden you're going to go, well, I want to have his money. And then the other person said, well, no, why has Fred got it? I'm worse off than he is. And
Well, maybe I could be a fun prime minister if I was a prime minister for a day, and I could just say, look, just for the heck of it, those that want to do this, you can have a go at it.
Now, there you
and
go.
And anybody who has an issue with it, forget it. How about that? Would that work?
Now, that's really good. I like that. This can actually work.
Yes, cool. I like to make it work.
Especially when we find out there's not one multimillionaire that actually steps forward.
That could be the challenge, couldn't it?
So that's your frivolous answer. A serious answer then?
The serious answer would have to be to do with education.
Right.
Because having been a teacher for a number of years and just seeing children at risk, particularly within the education system, I think personally, from what I know, this is my own opinion, obviously, I do not think academisation is working. And I know that, as I say, from personal experience with people, friends I know who have been in education, head teachers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a phenomenon known as disappeared heads. I don't know if you've heard of it, but there's actually a lot of head teachers who've been in education many years, got a real heart for children, who are disappearing. And because the academies have come in, what has happened to these head teachers is hidden, because a lot of them sign non-disclosures because they're actually got rid of in such underhand and horrible ways. There's many head teachers that have had nervous breakdowns, are on the edge, because this chokes me up to talk about it, to be honest. Yeah. Because I'm talking personally, my sister was a head teacher that totally has been annihilated through an academy experience. Because what is the issue? There's no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
The academies actually are just running roughshod, and I question their motives. And I think that's what I think would need to happen with academies, is a public inquiry. So the first thing I would do is make a public inquiry. See, it's choking me to talk about
it. Yeah, I can see.
Because it impacts kids. It impacts kids. And you're getting rid of teachers and those that really, truly have a heart for kids, not just the numbers and the money that's involved, and not just the academics either. Because, again, the education of most academies now, they get the money based on the results and so on and so forth. So there's so much political stuff goes on there. But in a nutshell, a public inquiry into the impact of academies and how, what's happened to get them to where they are today.
Great answer. I do remember going back, maybe was it 25, 30 years ago or something like that? And I remember the statistics that 25% of all teachers, I think at one time or another, take quite a few weeks off because of stress and mental health issues. So that was 25%. If that was 25, 30 years ago, I'd hate to think what the figures are now.
Yeah.
So yes, exactly. Public health inquiry on the social standings and the health issues surrounding teachers and what goes on with academies. Yes, you've got my vote on that.
Good.
Just very disappointed, Mr. Bond. He says, stroking the white cat. You didn't choose Oxford and the cars.
I could start ranting there.
Well, if we've got nothing else to do in the next 45, 50 minutes on the podcast, I'll bring that in. Yeah, you'll know that I'm bored stiff. The answers have been rubbish. Oh, tell me about Oxford then.
Tell me about the car situation.
Brilliant. Thank you. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, Chrissy?
Again, it was difficult to pin something down here because the premise was not to do with family events. Of course, so many family events are enjoyable.
Yes.
But the one that I've actually put down was, the work I'm doing, the mosaicing, actually, is where the mosaicing comes in. And also the connection a little bit with the people I've connected with around the world that are working with children at risk.
Yes.
And there was a couple, in fact, the two women that I've known in Uganda, and one of them is a Ugandan lady and one is an English lady, but they've kind of worked together in the network that's there in Kampala of kind of connecting different projects that are working mm-hmm. with children at risk. And so years ago, they actually bought some land together, thinking they were there for the long haul. They weren't just, you know, flybys, were the vision for children. And this land, they've been years building. And the last time I saw them, they'd came over to the UK. And I just said, look, I would love to come and visit your new property because it's just about finished. You know, they've been years doing it, slowly paying for it and so on. And I said, I'd love to come and do a mosaic. I would just really love to gift you a mosaic for this. So my favorite day, actually my most enjoyable day, I had to give you the context, was sitting in this, it was a large kind of, they've got, the land is on a hillside, so it's a beautiful view out across onto another mountain, uh-huh. just quite away from the center. And in my memory was doing this mosaic, I'd got to the point where it wasn't the messiness, it was just the pleasure of piecing all the bits together and worshipping and singing. And the whole day was just, I felt like the angels were dancing around. It was one of those days. It was, you know, I was on my own, but it was just that space of being on my own and really sensing the presence of God and just loving what I was doing and feeling so fulfilled, you know, to be doing a gift for somebody. So that was my most enjoyable day. And that's this year. So,
well, that's a brilliant answer as well. And because it's outside of family events, you weren't able to choose what happened yesterday on your birthday.
I know.
Yes. And for those who are saying, well, what did she do? Perhaps you could like to share what you did yesterday then on your birthday.
Yes, it was. It would have been my most enjoyable day, I think. Well, one of them, because my daughter is getting married in May. So I had the pleasure of going with her to a place where you try on the dresses. You know, you kind of get given a glass of champagne and you get treated like royalty and princesses yourselves. And so I actually, and it was my birthday. So as you said, so it was a double kind of fun thing to do.
And of course, had I been your husband, I couldn't have thought of anything better than going around watching people put wedding dresses on. So what did your husband do?
My husband actually is, he's a handyman, for want of a better word. He basically does everything. So he's a very well-loved person because people love him fixing things and mending things. Things that people give up on, he will fix it.
But what did he do to celebrate the fact that, you know, he didn't go out to look at a wedding dress?
He was actually building. He was doing something for somebody, which he usually does.
So, he was able to use work as an excuse.
Yeah, sorry, I've got work to do, darling. Okay.
Work saves the day. Of course, there must be blokes saying, oh, I'd love to do that. And that's not,
you know, there's some things I think you've got to just keep to the girls and some things you've got to keep to the blokes. I'm one of those. I do think that.
Question five, what has been your most embarrassing moment then, please?
Years ago. I mean, there's quite a few of them, but some of them you just can't repeat, can you? If people were really honest in this question, Martin, you would probably have to edit it. But the one that stand out for me is I was nursing in London, in Whitechapel, in East London, along Commercial Road, if anybody knows that area. And it was really late at night. I think we'd been out, you know, beyond hours pubbing with my friends. And for some reason, I was walking back along Commercial Road on my own. And as I was walking along, there was this chap, and he had a Stetson, he looked like a Texan. He had a big Stetson hat on. And obviously pitch black, maybe 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was a little bit nervous about being on my own as a woman, particularly. Mm-hmm. But this guy started kind of shouting at me, kind of. And I thought he was saying, howdy, partner. you know. So I was going, oh, howdy, partner, you know. And he was getting nearer and nearer and more insistent, howdy, partner. And I'm like, oh, howdy, partner. And I was walking faster and faster, and he was walking faster and faster. Eventually, when he got up to me, he just said to me, and I realized what he was asking is, how'd you get to Poplar?
Oh, brilliant.
I shouted at him, howdy, partner, for the last 5 minutes. Well, that was very embarrassing because it showed my kind of, you know, stylization of somebody in a tits and hat. You automatically assume they're saying, howdy, partner, to you.
That's brilliant. And this is where you listen. And I never realised, but it turned out to be J.R. Ewing himself, Mr. Hagman.
I couldn't tell the hat went over his eyes.
Did he laugh in the end when you explained what you said?
No, I didn't. I did explain how you got to Poplar. Unfortunately, it took him way beyond me because he was walking faster than me and I slowed down. Hugely relieved that it wasn't some axe murder or something.
Yeah.
Because that whole area has been known as Jack the Ripper area.
Yeah, Whitechapel, of course, in the 1880s. Yeah. Great stuff. Well, thank you very much indeed for that. Where should we start then? I mean, you mentioned mosaics. No doubt we'll come on to mosaics. So where did this love of going around the world and wanting to help children who are severely at risk, where did that come from?
To start with, I don't think it was a love of going around the world. It's never been a love of going around the world. I think what the connection for me has always been about, you know, children. And at one point, it was actually, my husband and I, we had two children ourselves. The youngest was 5 months old. And my husband at that time was a civil engineer, working for a big construction company and wondering what on earth he was doing, working his butt off for somebody else and so on and so forth. And bumped into this young guy who had started a charity called Viva Network. And this charity, basically, he'd been a YWAM or YWAM course as a young guy. He was only very young, literally, I think in his 20s, he'd gone, spent his kind of inheritance, I think, to go in somewhere like Bolivia and work with children. And as a result of him travelling around, he realised that he knew the projects that were going on in the city where he was, but the projects didn't know about each other. So he got them all together and they all introduced each other and realised most of them were feeding the children all on one the same day. So that one meeting caused some of them to begin to connect. Well, why don't we do that Monday, you do Tuesday? And they began to be a bit more coherent about what their response to children.
Wow.
So this guy connected with my husband, and basically, because it grew, this vision, he basically was saying, who in the world is connecting the dots in cities where there's so many good-hearted Christians that want to help children at risk? So many, you know, the mothers that have got, you know, taking children off the streets have got a real heart.
Yes.
Most of them Christians, actually, who want to bring in children and love them and care for them. But nobody really knows about each other. And he was a very strategic thinker, this chap, Patrick, his name is. He started this charity called Viva Network, Life Viva, because it was in Latin America. And it kind of grew. So my husband then joined him because he said, look, I need a strategic person, because Patrick was a visionary. You know what the visionaries are like, you know, kind of running off all over the place. Whereas my husband is a civil engineer and being in construction, he's a very strategic thinker, get the project done, you know. So we took a huge step of faith. Patrick asked him, would you come and be my number two? And Patrick said, well, Brian never said no. He basically was open to the idea. And we found ourselves with two young children, miraculously, actually, supernaturally moving to Oxford, where it was based. That's why we moved to Oxford.
All right.
So my connection with the global scene really came out of this meeting this person who had put this in place. And so I went into the office. I hope this is making sense.
Mm-hmm.
As I went into the first time and met the Viva office where they had their base, Patrick met me. He said, oh, Chrissy, you're an intercessor. You're a prayer. He said, we've got a prayer room here. He said, you know, would you take on the prayer room? And at the time I had this two-year-old and a baby. And I thought, and I looked in this room and it was a little room, nothing in it. And I thought, well, how, you know, my issue was, how do you pray with a two-year-old and a baby? And I really began to, it's like God gave me strategy about making it a fun space. So I made it, was kind of, it was like almost a precursor to prayer rooms, you know, the 24/7 prayer. I made it an interactive space. And that began to get even more of the staff that were working there coming in, with looking at the world and praying for the world. I had a little squidgy globe we used to throw to the kids and get them praying for countries and things. So the connection with children at risk was all part of this amazing story and journey that my husband and I went on, really.
We hear it on and see it on the news, but we don't really know what it's like until people actually go there and come back and tell us.
Yeah.
So how bad is it wherever you've been regarding children at risk?
I think this is one of my saying, you become what you behold, or whatever you behold, you become. Mm-hmm. And I think there's two ways of looking at children at risk. You can look at it through the grid of this is horrendous. There's so much corruption in the world. Again, this gets me choked, you mm-hmm. know, because there is so much corruption and children are the ones that actually miss out. The next generation actually is not, this isn't so much about children. This is actually about just having a generational mindset. This is about the next generation and what they're coming into. So although we say children, we're thinking actually it's a whole generation here that are at risk potentially because of the different decisions of governments and the poor choices of how money is spent or education, so on and so forth. So when I look at different nations, you can look at, say, a lot of the African nations got really hit by the AIDS, for example. Mm. So you had a lot of child-headed households. In Asia, I mean, I'm very generalizing. In Asia, it's often the sex trafficking, actually, seems to be. So I'm very broad brushstroke saying wherever you go in the world, you see the evidence of corruption that's gone on that then causes children to be at risk. So what I've tried to do is when I've gone in places or had an opportunity to go somewhere is look through the grid of what is the good news here? What is being done here that is that can be duplicated or can be in some measure, you know, be a voice that will bring hope for this generation and to mobilize people to get on board with helping. So kind of, again, I don't know if that's answered your question fully because it's really hard to say what I found there because everywhere I've been has been different with the needs of children. But at the end of the day, when you're dealing with a corrupt world system, there's going to be, you can find it wherever you look, unspeakable things, unspeakable actually. Like I say, it chokes me, but I have to keep my eyes on beholding the good because that's what I want to become and that's what I want. The networks or the projects to be becoming something that's an example of what can happen when you get people that really believe in a God, actually. I mean, other than God, but God, it's a hopeless situation, actually, because it needs some very serious supernatural intervention.
I was going to ask you on that, because going to different countries, different faiths and things like that, how were you accepted being a Christian? Let's face it, you don't keep it under a bushel. How do they treat you?
What's interesting is that, well, a lot of the projects in many of the continents, they are Christian projects. So in one sense, it's a little bit of a Christian bubble in that respect. But it's what they're providing is often an alternative to what the government is doing, because sometimes the governments are doing nothing. Mm. So what they are modelling as a Christian in those environments is... And what we try to do as Viva is try to give more excellence to what they were doing. So, for example, in projects, you try and come along. So that because it's Christian, doesn't mean it has to be rubbish. You know what I mean? Or we don't have money. This is where we try and invest into the networks to build training for the project. So around a city, for example, you can get 10 projects that would come. One project itself wouldn't be able to pay for somebody to come and train them in child protection, for example, or whatever. But when you've got a network of 10 different projects that have come to because they want to learn together, you begin to start to put systems in place that actually then leverages the Christian response to be more excellent. Now you're talking, because then the government then looks at you, not because you're a Christian, but because you're doing best practice. And in many cases, the good news has been there's been an influence through the actual projects or the network that the government then has looked at and begun to use the networks. So that's how it's worked. So the response to you as a Christian hasn't been, I've gone in as a Christian. It's the excellence of the work, the heart to do well for children that then has begun to influence at government level. Because ultimately that is what needs to happen. There needs to be influence at a very high level.
Yeah, yeah. Because it seems to me that, and this is to your credit as well, that with all this experience of seeing what goes on abroad, coming back, you could have said, well, I'll make this the rest of my life. This is what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to get Christians from every country to finally join the dots, because that is something I've seen in my Christian faith walk, that Christians aren't very good at talking to each other. when it comes from different organisations. So that could have been your remit for the next several years, but then all of a sudden there's a change and Mosaics comes on board. So here's a nurse going around the world. What happened there?
There's a story to that, because when I did my teaching, so I was a qualified teacher. Like you said, you read out the list at the beginning. I'm thinking, oh, Polly, I have done a lot of things. But I was a qualified teacher, which is where I met Ruth Moyler, who was one of the guests you had on with the Interplaylands. I loved art, so I have been an artist through all this, and that's been a common thing. But when we first came to join Viva, my husband and I really felt we should put our money where our mouths were. And my children were young. I thought, how can we help children at risk that are here in Oxford? So we tried to become foster carers, basically. We started the route for that. And my very first mosaic was done as a result of the fact we ended up having real trouble getting approved as foster carers. It was a time when I think there was a lot of suspicion about Christians in foster care. I think they were kind of wondering, you know, if there was an agenda or whatever. I don't know. There was a lot of question about it. And we really had a tough time to be approved. And fortunately, we had a senior social worker who was on our side, but she was getting a lot of jip from higher pressure going on. So I gave up. I thought, well, okay, I'm not going to be a foster carer. I thought, that's too hard. You know what I mean? You have to jump through so many hoops. And so I got a tile and I smashed it up, and I was kind of did this mosaic based on our family of had sort of an angel over our family. My husband and myself were kind of represented, and then I put a third child with a shiny face, and my mosaics have all since then. I put kind of shine, like sticky back plastic, actually. I used, so I'm telling you a little secret on my mosaicing.
Blue Peter style, excellent.
Yeah, Blue Peter. Oh, I am the original Blue Peter kid, me. You can make it happen. And so this first mosaic was actually of our family with a foster child by faith, thinking, God, if you said this, then you have to make a way here, because it wasn't happening. And then it did happen. So that's that story. And that's how I began to get into mosaics. And then I just began to do more and more. And they were always two things, always sort of angelic. I had a sense of spiritual movement around stuff. And they were marking that. It was like, and sometimes it was for people I did it, or celebrating their lives. And the other thing is the shiny reflective surfaces. So that's my uniqueness. So that's how it began to grow.
And you now do mosaic events. So tell us more about that, please.
So the mosaic events has come because, again, what I realised is, in fact, it relates a little bit to the book Broken Pieces, which you mentioned at the beginning. The events have come sort of out of that, because the book is not just about me. It's to help people look at brokenness, perhaps in their lives, and see a way of processing brokenness to make it something beautiful. I don't know, is it kintsugi? There is a Japanese art where they break pots and then they seam the pieces together with gold.
Do you know what? I've seen that on the Great British Pottery Throwdown. It does exist.
There you go. So it's a similar kind of thing. It's like something beautiful out of brokenness. I mean, that's the whole thing. And you're forming something new. So the workshops come now. What I want to do really is connect with people that have had some area of brokenness in their life. So, for example, I'm now in Oxford getting involved with a housing association that work with the homeless. They've now rehoming homeless in communities. So I'm getting them together and going to do mosaics with them. So there's this kind of story that you can begin to tell, and people can begin to tell through their own experiences. So as much as people are having fun doing it, it's like there's it brings people together. It's imaginative. You can actually create something that gives you a sense of identity through it, a sense of your own journey, marking stuff. So the workshops come, I do them generally for the general public, but I'm also this year just going into, you know, like I say, charity homeless projects and stuff, where you can begin to help people, and this particular charity anyway in Oxford. So that's a bit more of an open door that's come my way. So that's good.
Wonderful. Chrissy, I just said at the beginning, off air, don't know where it's going to go. I want to take the gloves off now, okay. If that's okay. Yeah, in fact, I'm going to throw the paper away. I think you've got so much to give because of what you've done so far. So that's why I'm taking the gloves off. Yeah. Let's just imagine that I've got everybody that listens into a room. I bring you on stage.
Yeah.
And I want you to share with us, please, now, what you've learned so far from everything that you've done.
Okay.
So first thing, what have you learned so far about being a Christian and working in the world?
The biggest thing, and actually this will tell the story of the Roar, because the biggest thing has been the love of God. the absolute love of the Father towards us, whether we know him or not. Actually, this is generic, you know, even if people have never had a relationship with the Lord, God's heart is, you know, that none should perish, but all have everlasting life. So that's the biggest thing I've learned. And actually, what's interesting, working with children at risk, I believe every single one of us born, in effect, is a child at risk, aren't we? If we think about what, from the day we're born into the corruption of the world. And so we're impacted by that, either through generational line stuff or rubbish that happens to us, you know, that God never intended, you know. What happened, which really brought it home, the love of God, was I had an opportunity in 2004 to go to the Lausanne Forum for World Evangelization. Now, there's a big mouthful, but basically, it was started by Billy Graham. It's called Lausanne because it was started years ago. And the idea was that every 10 years, you gather global church leaders to come and look at the next 10 years, basically. So this was at Viva. I was at Viva at this point, and we had an opportunity because we were a global charity connected in with lots of people. We got invited into the mix of this big forum. Patrick, this is the guy who founded Viva, he had the opportunity of speaking at this gathering of 2,000 global leaders. And you're talking organizational, denominational leaders. So it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And we were going to put children on the agenda. What happened then? I knew Patrick's moment was going to be, we did a video of children at risk, etc., and the good news of what was happening. But Patrick's main thing was, you know, to say, look, when Jesus was with the disciples and the disciples began shooing away the children, the word is used very strongly. He was furious, actually, you know, the original Greek, I think it is. And so Patrick's opening line was going to be this: Jesus was furious because Jesus was saying, this is the kingdom here, you know, and it's something that's missing the disciples if they don't realize how important this generation or whatever is. And so we were in this auditorium, 2,000 key leaders, and Patrick got on the stage. And as he stood there, we saw the video, and then his opening line was, Jesus was, and on the word furious, there was this massive sonic boom. All the lights blipped, all the stage lights went, the big screens that were there disappeared, and you could have heard a pin drop. And that was when I first heard the roar from heaven.
So it wasn't stage managed then?
It wasn't stage managed, no. It was not stage managed. It was an absolute punctuation mark from heaven. That's all I can describe it as. It was like, oh my goodness. I felt it so strongly that it was like, Father's heart. It was like he'd had enough, you know what I mean? It was like, enough, pay attention here, pay attention, church leaders. This is a generation that, unless we begin to look at this next generation in 20 years time, they're going to be adults. So this is why, when you're asking me to speak to those listening right now, every single one of those are now adults, but at some point they were a child and could have had the opportunity to know much younger in their lives the goodness of God, the truth of God, and so on and so forth. That was 2004. We're now, it's actually 20 years now since that first roar that I heard. And I just think my question to the Lord now is, why am I not working with children anymore? And it's like, it's almost because that generation has now become the adults. And we have adults are full of still not knowing God, still not knowing the love of the Father. And I felt the love of the Father is so for humanity, so for the lost, you know. And it's also for the one. Because that's where in the foster care, this is what I've learned. Although it's the big picture stuff, you know, 2,000 church leaders, it was me sitting as a foster carer with one little boy who had been so damaged he was 6 or 7 at the time. I used to have to sit outside his bedroom every night because he was too fearful to go to sleep. And he used to have to see my foot. And I'd sit on this little rocking chair and I used to have to show my foot because he was terrified. And I remember he was angry. We were doing like extreme foster care at that point, which is actually where it's called therapeutic foster care, where children have already had multiple placement breakdowns. They're beyond being fixed, you know, and you are literally dealing with the fallout of messed up lives. And he was so angry, and he would swear at me every night, calling me all the names under the sun. I mean, literally. And this particular night, I was sitting on this armchair and I began to weep at the revelation of the love of the Father for the one, that Father loved this little lad And I felt every child that came to us got a place in our hands just to love as much as we could, to show the love of the Father. But that God's love is so much for each one of us to be reconciled to knowing we're loved, you know. So that's the big thing I would say. And this little boy, like I say, I wept. And I felt Jesus just show me this is how much, when he died, that's the level of love he had for us, because we're all messed up. We've all done wrong. But God's love is so forgiving. So like this little boy, you could look at him and the schools looked at him and everybody else looked at him and had kind of written him off, and he was they called him feral. But yet actually the love I felt for him was phenomenal. And it was a love that God gave me for him. And so it's the macro and the micro. It's the big picture. It's the small picture. So what I feel God has given me an incredible privilege of seeing both, you know, having the privilege of seeing at the global level, but also feeling at the one level that is this not just statistics here. It's the one that you sit in front of and you have living in your home with you who is so angry and hurt. You know, they're swearing, they're angry, and you have to learn to act counterintuitively and all that goes with foster care. And anybody who's a foster carer who maybe listen to this, they will know what I'm talking about. It's the toughest thing to do, to love children for whatever reason and needing homes and love.
Do you know what I so love about what you've just shared? The fact that we could have gone on the macro, we could have talked about the world and what you've learned from that, and immediately you just come down and pointed it to just the one.
Yeah.
And so often we get very complacent and thinking, oh, we've got to go for the big picture.
Yeah.
And I suppose in some ways, because, well, yeah, but you're living in Oxford, that's easy. Oxford, you think of the dreaming spires and Morse. And, of course, my heroes, the Inklings and everything else like that.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got Oxford. Christianity isn't needed in Oxford, surely. It's money belted. It's all there. So what have you seen on the smaller picture? Having been to the big picture, what have you seen the smaller picture and what's going on in Oxford now? And what can they learn from you?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting about Oxford because the world comes to Oxford, actually. Yeah. I mean, we've had people staying in our home. We opened our home to students at one point. So we had quite a few overseas students coming. And you've got an influence as a Christian in Oxford to really, if you're fortunate enough to live in Oxford and have a house, you know, just to be open to the tourists that come every year. You've got two very different, you know, flows of people. You've got all the tourists that come from all around the world, and you've got all the students that come in from all around the world. So it's almost a very transient place, really. It's a complex question you've asked, really, as a Christian. Because of the overwhelming nature when you look at the huge issues, you know, I just know that I'm not God, but God will use who I am in what's in my hands. And so it's what's in my hands. So for me, it is the art stuff. It is looking at who's around that I can do art with and where the doors open for me to do the local stuff, like with the homeless. There's, you know, there are homeless in Oxford, believe it or not. So there's charity work in Oxford, the homeless. So as somebody who is of faith, my whole journey is doing the stuff that doesn't count to God. Because like you say, you could think you're doing the best thing in the world, working with children at risk and working with the millions, maybe. But you know, unless God has called you to do it, it's wood, hay and stubble. Do you know that? And so I know that.
Now explain more on that, because that is a fascinating point. So tell us more.
The scripture is very clear. Jesus says, you know, you may have raised the dead. You may have, you know, done this, you know, that wherever the verse, I know scriptures, but I often don't know where the verses are. But Jesus said in that, didn't he? Oh, it doesn't matter if I will, on that day, I didn't know you. I will turn and say, I don't know you. So for me as a person of faith, my heart is to keep in the presence all the time, knowing the presence of the Lord in my life. And if I lose that, I know I can go off by the distractions of the needs of the world, because there are huge needs. And we can be deceived into thinking I don't want anybody listening to this think, oh, now I've got to go and work with children at risk. No, if your calling is to work with children, absolutely do what God is calling you to do. But Father doesn't want us to be, Jesus is the Savior, not us, you know. All we cause us to do is be obedient in what he's given in our into our hands. And it can be the very small things that we think are insignificant when we compare ourselves to others. And comparison of others is the biggest devil out, I think, because it's like, yeah, it can stop us fully being who we are, you know, and what God is actually unique reason that we're here on this earth, you know, and why we're here. And sometimes it can be for the one, you know, and some, like we talked about, but the wood, hay and stubble verse, that again is a very sobering verse, because it just makes me think, wow, I don't want to transition into wherever, you know, whatever is going to happen, whenever it's happening, you know, and stand before the Lord on judgment day and it be, you'll still say, but the works you've done count for nothing. They will get burned. Mm. So two kind of verses there that are very sobering when I think of my own, wherever I am in the world. And again, it's for whatever reason, Father's placed me here in Oxford. And I'm here until he leaves me somewhere else. And so, you know.
And this is what I think, what I was alluding to at the beginning, not realizing what you were going to share. Yeah. That, you know, you could have clearly gone on the conference circuit talking to people around the world, this is what I've done, this is what we do, we get charities together to talk blah de blah de blah, but no, you haven't, you've given that all up, and you're now in Oxford, and this isn't to decry Oxford at all, but you've given that all up. People listening today as Christians, or maybe not even Christians, think, well, what's the point then? What's the point? So what would you say?
The point is, I'm not looking at the immediate, I'm looking at the eternal. And I think I know enough, or my relationship with the Father is so deep. I think his desire for us is not just to tick the box, yes, I'm a Christian. His desire for us is to mature and become mature sons. So for me, my journey at the moment is being obedient to him, because I want to be mature. I don't want to be immature, just thinking, oh, this is, because I've said a lot there. I've said something there.
Keep going.
I think so often we can have the mentality, I'm a Christian, I've ticked the box, you know, I'm going to heaven. My own feeling is we bring the kingdom wherever we walk. We are walking as ones who represent the kingdom. So when we walk in a room, we bring the kingdom into the room, whether that's in a supermarket. I mean, seriously, we're talking very basic here. My walk in Oxford, I will walk into a supermarket and I know I can change an atmosphere. That's who we are. If we really fully know who we are as sons of God, that have his presence in us, the kingdom of God is within you, said Jesus. And I'm like, okay, the kingdom of God, I'm taking him seriously. The kingdom of God is within me. It's not out there, God help me, God help me, God help me. He's in me. And I'm like, wow. So that's my mindset now. It's very different. It's taken me many years to come to this place of journey with the Father that's beginning to reveal to me who I truly am as a son, that can believe I can change the atmosphere in places because God is in me, because his presence is with me, and because I'm following him, you know. So, again, I don't know if that's answered your question.
It's all warming up to what I'm going to ask you in return, because for me, in my walk so far, just because you become a Christian, that's actually you're now at point A.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just getting to point B, because once you get to point B, God will say, well, actually, now I want you to go to point C and then point D and you keep going on. But it means then that you have to realize that when you became a Christian, you still got all the baggage with you.
Yes.
It doesn't go overnight. No. You've got to actually want to let it go in the first place, because all too often, from a psychological point of view, you'd rather hold on to the baggage because you're used to it. It's your protection. And God is saying, no, I want to take it off you, which leads into your book, Broken Pieces, and about being broken yourself. So please share more about being broken and what it means to you now.
I think the brokenness, it can feel sometimes the things that happen to you, you can say, why God did you allow that? Why has that happened? But every single thing you could look at on the surface as being something like, that's really awful. Somehow the learning in it, that being open, you can either look at things, this is the story of the stepping stone or stumbling block, isn't it? You can either see what's happening in front of you as the stumbling block, like I say, what you behold, you become, or the stepping stone. And so for me, I just, because of my faith in God, to be honest, it's not just blind faith. It's absolutely knowing the relationship and the love of the Father. I know that whatever happens to me, I'm turning my face towards the Father and saying, okay, what happened there? And it's not, I don't do any blame stuff. I just know his goodness. I know, okay, whatever, there may be consequences of stuff I've done that's caused this or whatever, because that often is what goes through our minds, isn't it? Why do these things happen?
Yeah.
But I think for me, I overcome that by looking at, okay, how can I change in this? What are you showing me? So the brokenness, every single story in that book, there's like glory. They're glory stories, actually, because of how I've come through them with and in relationship with the Father. Because without him, I wouldn't be here, really. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here, because that's the truth, because some of them were too tough, you know. But because what it did was it kept turning me into him, you know.
Yeah.
So the brokenness angle is, you know, I think Father really uses, I don't believe he ever causes the stuff to happen. I think the stuff is the consequences of living in a corrupt world. But he's brought us into faith in Jesus that can bring us out of corruption as ones that can shine as lights in the earth. And that's where I feel almost the less I am, you know, the more I kind of die to myself. I mean, again, that's all the Christian calling, isn't it? To die to yourself. The more we do that in those tough times, the more the glory comes. And there's so many glory stories. I mean, that's the book, really, is a little bit of that. The more those things I've shared, it's like I died to myself having cancer. Well, okay, it's a death. Oh, you're facing death, really. Yeah. It's death or life. It was such a defining thing. And I thought, well, actually, I want life, but I'm dead anyway every day. So there was a whole process of stuff going on with each story, which I share a little bit in the chapters.
The number of times I've said to Christians and been ridiculed for it because they don't understand die to self. I didn't understand what it was. Yeah. As far as I was concerned, yes, God, I'll do this for you. And I did, you know, I put everything down and went for it. But I didn't fully understand what die to self meant. And I just get the feeling that this is me personally speaking, and I'd like you to counter it or whatever. But in the Western world today, in Christianity terms, it's more a feeling of, well, I've got my calling card. I've got my airfare ticket to go to heaven. I know that I'm going to get through. I might not be in business class. I might just struggle to get into cattle class, but I'm in. Yeah. And as if I've done the occasional job for God and everything else like that. So it's as if that is the main thing these days.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I kind of alluded to it earlier a little bit. I think our purpose of being here on earth is to mature as sons, to truly know who we are. Mm-hmm. I think it's a shame when we only have the mentality, I've got my ticket to heaven, because we miss out on what we could become. And we only get to live on this earth once. And I really believe God's put us here for a purpose, to become something here that will be what we are in heaven. I mean, there's parables, aren't there, in scripture that allude to that? You know, through the people who are given the gifts, they're given the talents.
Yes.
You know, and we're given the talent, we're given gifts to be in relationship with him. And it's like Father saying, what are you doing? What are you doing with what I've given you in the faith of my son and in what you can become now as a new creation being? What are you doing with that? And then you begin to look with hope. You begin to see, actually, I could be like Jesus. Hello. This is a purpose. This is the purpose of us being here on the earth, is to become Jesus. We're his hands and feet. We are becoming Christ-like. But the only way to become Christ-like is through that death to self. So that's where I totally agree with you. Yet to, we're called for so much more than just the ticket for dying. I mean, I don't want to, obviously people, once we've received Jesus, I believe there is, God has, we're Christians, mm-hmm. but I'm just saying there's so much more. I think there's baby Christians, there's Christians that never have matured to the level that God wants us to mature. And I actually, do you know, in these last year, I would say, I feel like I have come to a blank page where I feel like I know nothing in all my years of my Christian walk and all that I've experienced and the beautiful people I've met. I'm literally at a place now where I have a blank page in front of me and I'm looking at my Father's face. I'm saying, Father, I feel like I'm just learning. I'm just beginning to learn what it is to be a son in the earth, to be one who is your child, who can represent you in terms of governance, in terms of connection with just like Jesus. Yeah. Just like Jesus. So I look at Jesus's life and thinking, I can be walking in, and if he only ever did what he saw the Father doing. And I'm thinking, God, I want to see what you're doing. I want to see. I don't want to just hear your voice anymore. Because for years I was, you know, into the prophetic movement and stuff, and I am prophetic. But I'm looking at the face of the Father and thinking, I don't know how to really see you. What is that? I'm like, no, I'm asking Father and beginning to journey into that.
Yes.
To become like Jesus, because Jesus only did what he saw the Father doing. So I'm like, well, we're called to be like Jesus. So I think to study the life of Jesus and see who Jesus was and think, actually begin to have faith, that's why we're here on earth, to be like him, to be shining lights like him. And Jesus said, to do the greater things. Hello. It's like, that's exciting, isn't it? Don't you think? To do the great things. And that gives me such hope, because that's worth dying for me, to think that God himself dwells in me, and that the more I die to myself, the more he's enabled through his spirit in me and so on to accomplish what he wants to accomplish through my body, through me being here on earth. The more joy will come to me personally, and it is doing, and the more fulfilled we are, and the more victory I think we see over the corruption that's around us, because we shine as lights. That's what we're called to do.
So in layman's terms, or as I used to say, in Janet and John terms,
yes.
For those who are saying die to self, what does that actually mean? Well, let's get you to tell me, what does it mean to you?
I think a lot of it is to do with our thoughts. It's to do with the stuff of our soul. It's to do with our emotions, our mind, our choices, our will. It's all the gateways of the soul, almost, you know, because for me, sometimes I have to choose how to think. I'll give you a break. Let's earth it, Janet and John. let's use the example of husband and wife, for example. That's a common one, isn't it? We're all in close relationships where we can get really irritated with each other, and we can end up in habitual ways of thinking. Now, in my walk with Jesus, I'm being challenged. Actually, Chrissy, that isn't like me. How you're thinking right now about your husband isn't how I think about him, you know. So I will die to my own self, my own irritation or my own anger or my own whatever it is that's come up that is not godly, that has not a reflection of Jesus. And I will turn my face into the Father, and I will literally breathe him in, almost breathe God in, to transform the way I think about somebody, and whether it be my husband or whoever might have irritated or got under my skin. And that changes my attitude, and that challenges my attitude, because then I'm asking myself questions, and I'm confessing and repenting before God, so that I don't want to have corruption in me. Because I think sometimes in our soul realm, at those gateways and then our emotions, there's corruption there. There's wrong ways of thinking that don't help us to become sons, but they're habitual things. And we have to begin to face those habitual things and listen to the still small voice of Holy Spirit when we're convicted about stuff, to say, actually, God, I really do want to deal with that. And I want to die to self. That's dying to self. When I say, okay, that's enough of that now. Come on, Chrissy. You know, pull yourself up. Let's change the mindset. Let's change the tape in your head that says something this way to another way. And then that's very practically what I would do.
Of course, there's a big difference here, though, between we're taking Mr. and Mrs. Janet and John here.
Yeah.
If John was abusing his wife, Janet, there's a whole big difference there between dying to self on that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well said. Yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out. Yeah.
Because that's a total new ball game.
It is.
Of course, you know, and if that is happening, then we're really sorry to hear that.
Yes, totally.
Go and see a solicitor. Go and see somebody. If it means both of you going, go both of you. But we're talking about other issues here as well that come into play on die to self.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you said that. That's very good. Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time. We've mentioned RAW. What are you doing in Oxford these days then? So people can come up to date, and then they can then go and look at your website, obviously, to see more.
So the website is like a shop front, if you like, of the different things I do, because I kind of have a lot of different creative projects. So I'm actually, the Interplay Lens has been on that, because I've done a little bit of that, of, you know, helping people build them and so on and so forth. The mosaicing that I do is on that. I also do painting art, sort of, I call it encounter art, a little bit like where you connect in with Father or Jesus or Holy Spirit, and then you allow them through some questions that I ask. I take people through a process of doing painting layers of, you don't have to be an artist to do it. It's just a really fun way of using color and emotions. It's a very kind of mindful, deep way of connecting in with the Lord, you know, that bypasses our thinking. Art's very good like that. So basically on the raw, which is, I think for me, it's the heart of God. I hope it's come across, the heart of God for who you are. That's the raw. The raw is his passion and love for each one of us. And the little pieces he's given me are through the process of art to begin to connect with the love of the Father, connect with stuff going on in our lives, being for mindfulness and well-being. So a lot of what I do helps people come to a place of well-being, process traumas, process hurts and things like that, that help them walk out into a place of, you know, freedom, really.
And if people want to know more about you on your website and maybe even contact you because they've been challenged in a good way, want to contact you, how can they do it? And what's your website address, please?
My website is www.the-raw.org.
Raw spelled R-O-A-R.
Yeah, so it's the and then a hyphen R-O-A-R.org. From there, actually, you can email me. There's a connection there for emails.
Two more questions. Mm-hmm. First question will lead into the second question, which obviously is who your Christian hero is. And obviously the Christian hero has to be dead and not in the Bible. So I'm looking forward to find out the answer on that. Mm-hmm. But the number of people who, when I do the Christian hero slot, choose a certain person whose initials are C and S and his surname is Lewis, or the initials J and R and R and surname Tolkien.
Yeah.
It seems to be fundamental now. That's what everyone's choosing. And of course, you're living in Oxford.
Yes.
And I can't help but always mention to these people, oh, we've got to talk about the Inklings and the pub, the Eagle and Child. And I was horrified to hear the Eagle Child is still closed.
Yeah, it was bought by some.
So what we're going to do about it, what can we do to open it? Because people don't realise just how I think it important is from a Christian point of view, because that's where they would go, not just only to talk about, here's the latest story written about a hobbit or whatever. Yeah. I certainly learnt in my Christian faith to discuss over a pint while I was feeling sort of rubbish or whatever, or what can we do? To me, it's a crying shame that the history of where C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien and all the others that form the Inklings, that pub is closed. So what have you heard about it reopening?
The last I heard was it has been bought by somebody who has every intention in reopening it. I don't know if you've ever been in the pub. It's a very small, it's not very health and safety aware. So I would imagine it would cost a lot of money to keep the authenticity of the place, but get it up to the kind of standard of a pub that anybody who purchased it, if they realised the income generation that could be bought through having it done up. So I'm sure that's not been lost on people. I do not know who it is that's bought it, but I do know that they are intending to open it.
Brilliant.
But it needs to be done up. So.
And the spin-off of that from a financial point of view, oh, try our latest beer, it's Aslan Ale or Fawn Bitter and all that sort of,
Yeah, endless.
Yeah, the commercialisation. Not that would ever happen, of course.
You could have the Hobbit room and you could have the Narnia room.
Couldn't you just? Yeah, well, I think maybe you and I should go and buy it then. There you go.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I've got 2 and 6. You can offer, I don't know, a signed copy of your book, The Broken Pieces. That'll do it.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
All it remains for me to say is, Chrissy Wilkinson, who is your Christian hero, please?
I've chosen him because he sums up many heroes I have that are alive still that I can't mention because they're still alive, who are the nameless, faceless ones that are working because of the heart for children at risk that are absolute champions. And it's George Muller.
Yes.
Bristol, there you go. George Muller, you'd know him.
He's my hero.
Is he?
Oh, yes.
There we go.
So you tell me more about my old mucker, George.
You probably know a lot more about him than I do, but all I did was read a book about George Muller and just who he was as somebody who was so in relationship with the Lord to the point where the faith level of the man and the generosity of the man and the vision and the journey, I think everything about him was an overcomer. And so he inspires me because he's overcome, but it was never a selfish intent, the heart that he had for children at risk. If anybody doesn't know who he is, it was in Bristol, and he really just built or began to develop places where children could live that were street children in those days. And so he gave them a home. I mean, you probably know a lot more of the facts than I do in terms of how many homes he ended up having, but he was thousands of children eventually who he rehomed and gave, you know, gave love to and cared for. So that's George Muller. Yeah.
Died in the late 1890s at a ripe old age. And what people don't remember so much about George Muller was that he came over from Germany and he wanted, when he became a Christian, to save the Jews.
Oh,
and then he caught a tuberculosis. I can't remember now what it was. But anyway, he had to go down to Totnes in Devon. The doctor sent him down there. So this is, what, about the 1840s, 1850s. And he recuperated there, came back to Bristol. That's where he saw the street children, wanted to do something about it. And of course, he never left. Yeah. And so he then, as we say, died to self what he wanted to do because God was actually showing something else.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it wasn't until he retired in his late 70s that actually his real life took off because God took him around the world not once but twice. Mm. You know, so he was speaking in New York. He was going all around the world. His wife saved him on a train in India. He had a very bad incident. Yeah, an incredible bloke.
I think it was traveling. He was about 88.
Every possibility. He saw Bristol City play football.
You did bring everything back to football.
Yeah. I might have been making that bit up, but yes. And the other thing was, and this is for people to be encouraged by, you might have been praying all your life for somebody to become a Christian. And George Muller prayed all his life for his six friends that he had back in Germany, because that's where he came from. And as he was nearing his deathbed, five of the six had become Christians. The sixth one hadn't. And I think that really upset him. And when he died, the sixth person came to his funeral in Bristol and became a Christian.
Yeah, I love that.
You might not see it in your own lifetime, but look what happens as a result.
Yeah, so beautiful. That's faithful.
George Muller, great man. Well, thank you for ending up on that. That's chuffed me to bits. Thank you also for explaining die to self, because that is an expression that seems to be cropping up more and more now. So. Chrissy, I wish you well for the future. Where are you going as far as where you think God's taking you over the next few months and years ahead?
The Roar is a kind of business. I mean, my vision is to, you know, have income coming in that then can support the various champions. Like I say, the nameless, faceless ones who are also my heroes, who, why George Muller is the person I've chosen, they're doing virtually what he's done and did, or, you know, now in various countries in the world. You know, my heart is to be having an income stream that's coming in. That's not why I'm doing it, but just that it will become a business that will prosper. And the business really is only at a very early stage, to be honest. It's only in the last probably 12 months I started doing this. But it's tied up with the Roar very much, and a sense of permission now I sense from the Lord that I can do this now. Yeah, appreciate if people think of me, hold me in your hearts to see a release of things for these other champions around the world that are working with children.
And now that you've got your little baby girl married, or to be married in May,
yeah,
the time is yours.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, let's see what happens on that one. Chrissy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeez, God bless. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
I've noticed this in the church too. The church is not immune from it. That since the decline of Christianity in the West, I'd say, by the way, when we talk about the decline of Christianity, always got to say in the West, because Christianity in the rest of the world is increasing.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think of 17 countries where Christianity is declining, 16 are Western, what we would call Western.
The 17th being?
I don't know. I wasn't there for the lecture, so I just heard the stat.
Antarctica, most probably.
Yeah, Antarctica, it's not doing so well.
In those penguins.
The penguins are resistant.
Yeah.
They're very resistant. There's a particular feature to the landscape in the West, but Christians and Christianity seem to be declining in numbers and in attendance and in political influence. And so there's an element of anxiety about that. And I want to actually say Christians shouldn't be so anxious, actually, because we've got something quite positive and non-anxious to say about politics.
So please join me in the next episode of Off-Grid Christianity with special guest Michael Jensen. Until then, cheerio.